A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Here's what Daniel wrote us. Third in the set, we've done Asian pallet standards and container load calculation and the European Eurobox world. Now round it out, US logistics standards and why America does almost all of it differently. He wants us to start with the pallet, the GMA 48 by 40 inch. Why those dimensions, how the Grocery Manufacturers Association ended up setting a de facto national standard, and what the other common U.S. footprints are. The 42 by 42 drum pallet, 48 by 48, the 36 by 36, then stringer versus block construction, and why the U.S. stuck with four-way limited stringer pallets while Europe standardized on the block-built EPAL.
Then he goes into the pooling economy. CHEP Blue, Pico Red, IGPS Plastic, Whitewood One-Way Pallets, and how a U.S. shipper actually gets a pallet back, or doesn't.
And then the trucking layer, which is where he says the real divergence is. The 53-foot dry van as the unit of American freight. Internal dimensions. How many GMA pallets fit on the floor, and why it's that number. Pinwheeling. How it compares to a 40-foot high cube. Also the 48-foot legacy trailer, the 28-foot pub for LTL, and domestic 53-foot intermodal containers, which aren't ISO boxes and can't go to sea. He wants to know why an import in a 40-foot ocean container almost always gets transloaded into a 53-foot domestic trailer at the port, and what that transload actually costs and buys you.
Then the weight and legal envelope, the 80,000-pound federal gross limit, the bridge formula, axle weights, why you have space left but you're already overweight, is the normal condition for dense freight, and how that reshapes how Americans load. Then the classification layer, which he says has no real European equivalent. NMFC freight classes and density-based LTL pricing, how a class gets assigned, what a reclass or a weight and inspection bill feels like when it lands. Plus the practical grammar. Bowl versus a European CMR note, dock height, dock levelers, liftgate service, appointment scheduling, detention, and driver accessorials, and why residential delivery is a surcharge category.
And the through line, imperial versus metric all the way down. What actually breaks when a European or Asian supplier ships to a US warehouse and the numbers don't divide cleanly? Carton size for a 1200mm pallet landing on a 1290mm one. Overhang, rack bay depths, and how much that mismatch quietly costs. Where the US system is genuinely better, where it's just stubborn, and what an importer shipping into America should design their packaging around from the start.
That's a lot. That's basically a textbook.
It's a whole freight curriculum in one prompt. Let's start with the pallet, because everything else stacks on top of it, literally.
The GMA pallet, 48 inches by 40 inches. That's 12 19mm by 1016, give or take. And the origin story is interesting. It wasn't a government standard. It wasn't an engineering committee. It was the Grocery Manufacturers Association in the 1960s saying, we need one pallet that works for everyone shipping canned goods and cereal boxes to supermarkets.
So a trade association just set the national standard.
By sheer market weight. Grocery was the dominant freight category moving through U.S. distribution, and if you wanted to sell to a supermarket chain, you put it on the pallet they used. The GMA spec became the de facto standard because the alternative was chaos. Every retailer with their own footprint, every manufacturer with different racking. The 48 by 40 emerged as the consensus size that worked for rail cars, for truck beds, for warehouse racking that was already being built. It's not that someone did a mathematical optimization and arrived at 48 by 40. It's that 48 by 40 was already widespread and the GMA formalized it.
And the other footprints?
48 by 48 is the big square, used a lot in chemical, in bulk bags, in anything where you want a larger footprint and don't need to fit through a standard door. The 42 by 42 is the drum pallet. It's designed so 455-gallon steel drums sit exactly on it, each drum in a corner, no overhang. and the 36x36 is a specialty pallet, often used in beverage, sometimes in retail displays where the pallet itself becomes part of the floor fixture. But the GMA pallet is something like 30% of all pallets in circulation in the US. It's the one that defines warehouse design.
So Strina versus Block. This is where the US and Europe really diverged.
Right. A stringer pallet uses two or three long boards, the stringers, running the full 48-inch length with deck boards nailed across the top and bottom. The classic GMA pallet is a three-stringer design. The fork tines can enter from two sides, the 40-inch sides, but not from the 48-inch sides, because the stringers are solid boards with no notches. You can cut notches into the stringers to make them partial four-way entry, and a lot of US pallets do that, but it's still not the same as a true block pallet.
And the block pallet is what Europe standardized on.
The EPAL Euro pallet is block construction. Instead of continuous stringers, you have 9 blocks, 3 rows of 3 with deck boards on top and bottom. That gives you full four-way entry. A forklift or pallet jack can enter from any side. That matters enormously in European logistics, where trucks are narrower, warehouses are tighter, and you're constantly maneuvering in confined spaces. The US didn't need that as badly. Our warehouses are sprawling, our aisles are wider, our trucks are bigger. The two-way limitation of a stringer pallet was annoying but not a deal-breaker. And stringer pallets are cheaper to manufacture, fewer pieces, simpler assembly, mostly nails and softwood. So the US stayed with the cheaper option because the operational penalty was lower.
That's a pattern we're going to see all through this. The US chooses cheaper up front, and the infrastructure is big enough to absorb the inefficiency.
Now, the pooling economy. This is where it gets interesting. In Europe, the EPAL pallet system is a true exchange pool. You deliver goods on an EPAL pallet, the receiver gives you an equivalent EPAL pallet back, and the pallets circulate. There's a whole quality inspection infrastructure around it. In the US, pallet exchange never really worked at scale. Receivers would keep the good pallets and hand back junk, or they'd claim they didn't have enough to exchange, and it was a constant source of friction, so the pooling model emerged instead.
CHEP and PICO.
CHEP is the giant, blue-painted pallets owned by Brambles, an Australian company. They operate something like 300 million pallets and containers globally. In the US, you don't buy CHEP pallets, you rent them. You pay a fee per pallet, per trip, or per day. CHEP handles the reverse logistics. They have depots all over the country. They collect, inspect, repair, and reissue. PICO is the competitor. Red Pallet, smaller but significant, originally PICO Pallet, and now owned by a private equity firm. Both are block pallets, by the way. CHEP's standard US pallet is a 48x40 block pallet with full four-way entry. So the pooling companies actually brought block pallet design into the US mainstream, even while the one-way whitewood stringer pallet remained the cheap default.
And IGPS?
Plastic pallets, RFID tagged, lighter than wood. They're used a lot in food and pharma where hygiene matters. No splinters, no nails, washable. But they're more expensive and they have their own issues. Plastic pallets can warp in racking if the load isn't evenly distributed, and they're slippery. Loads shift more easily. IGPS had a rough patch years back with some, let's say, questionable business practices, but they're still in the market.
And the whitewood one-way pallet. That's the one you see behind every grocery store.
That's the disposable pallet. Softwood, stringer construction, built to survive one trip. It costs maybe $12 to $15 new. You ship your product on it, the receiver does whatever they want with it. Some have pallet recycling programs, some throw them in a compactor, some sell them to pallet recyclers who sort and resell. It's a one-way ticket. And that's the fundamental difference. The US pallet economy runs on a mix of pooled rental pallets and disposable one-way pallets with very little of the exchange pool model that Europe built around EPAL.
So how does a US shipper actually get a pallet back?
They don't. Not directly. If you're using CHEP, CHEP handles retrieval, but you're paying for that service. If you're using whitewood, you've priced the pallet into the cost of goods and you never see it again. The exception is closed-loop systems, a manufacturer shipping to their own distribution centers, or a dedicated fleet running the same route back and forth. Those guys can use heavier, more durable pallets and get them back. But for the general market, the pallet is a consumable. Europe treats pallets as a reusable asset. The US treats them as packaging.
All right, let's move to the trucking layer, because this is where the scale difference really shows up.
The 53-foot dry van. This is the standard unit of American over-the-road freight. Internal dimensions, about 52 feet 6 inches long, about 98 to 100 inches wide inside, about 110 inches high. That interior width, call it 100 inches, is the key number for pallet loading.
How many GMA pallets fit on the floor?
26, loaded straight. Here's the math. A GMA pallet is 48 inches by 40. If you load them with the 48-inch side facing the length of the trailer, that's called straight loading, you can fit two side by side because 2 times 48 is 96 inches, and the trailer interior is about 100. So, two across. Then down the length, 52 feet is 624 inches. Divide by 40 inches per pallet, you get 15.6. So 15 rows of 2, which is 30 pallets, but wait, that's if the pallets are turned the other way.
You just contradicted yourself.
I did. Let me walk it back. If the 40-inch side faces the length, then you get 2 pallets across with the 48-inch side spanning the width. 2 times 48 is 96, fits in 100-inch width. Then along the length, each pallet takes 40 inches. 624 divided by 40 is 15.6. So 15 positions, 2 across, that's 30 pallets. But you can't actually get 30 GMA pallets into a 53-foot trailer because the door opening and the need for some clearance eat into it. The practical number is 26. And the reason is that you lose a few inches at the nose and the tail, and you need a little gap between pallets or you'll never get them out again.
26. And pinwheeling?
Pinwheeling is when you alternate the orientation of each pallet. One with the 48-inch side across, the next with the 40-inch side across, and so on, creating a pattern that looks like a pinwheel from above. It lets you squeeze in an extra pallet or two, but it's a pain to load and unload, and it only works if your pallets are perfectly square loads with no overhang. It's not standard practice for most freight. It's a trick you use when you're desperate to maximize a trailer.
And how does this compare to a 40-foot-high cube container?
A 40-foot-high cube ISO container is about 39 feet 5 inches long internally, about 92 inches wide, about 106 inches high. You can fit 20 Euro pallets, 1200 by 800, in a 40-foot container loaded with the 1200 side across. For GMA pallets, you get 21 if you load them carefully. So the 53-foot trailer gives you roughly 25% more floor positions than a 40-foot ocean container. That's why transloading happens.
Explain the transload. An import arrives at the Port of Los Angeles in a 40-foot container. What happens next?
The ocean container isn't going to a Walmart distribution center. It's going to a transload facility, essentially a cross dock near the port. The container is unloaded, the freight is sorted, and it's reloaded into a 53-foot domestic trailer. Sometimes it's combined with freight from other containers, consolidation. The 53-foot trailer then moves inland by truck or by domestic intermodal rail.
And the cost?
A transload might cost $300 to $600 per container, depending on the facility, the complexity, the labor. That sounds like an extra expense, but it saves money overall. The ocean container is expensive to move inland if it's not going directly to a facility near the port. Drayage, chassis rental, per diem charges on the box, it adds up. And a 53-foot trailer carries more freight per mile. If you're moving freight from LA to Chicago, you want it in a 53-foot trailer, not a 40-foot ocean box. The transload pays for itself in reduced line haul costs, plus you avoid the risk of container detention charges if the box sits too long at the destination.
So the 53-foot trailer is the unit of domestic freight, and the 40-foot container is the unit of international freight, and they meet at the transload facility.
And they're not compatible. A 53-foot domestic intermodal container, the kind that goes on a rail flat car, isn't an ISO container. It's longer, it's often wider, it's built to U.S. domestic standards, and it's not certified for ocean stack. You can't put it on a ship. It exists entirely within the North American land bridge. The 48-foot trailer is the legacy standard. Those are still around, but 53 is dominant now. And the 28-foot pup trailer is the LTL workhorse. Less-than-truckload carriers use pups because they're maneuverable in cities, and they couple two of them together as doubles for line haul.
Let's talk weight. 80,000 pounds.
The federal gross vehicle weight limit for a 5-axle tractor trailer on the interstate system is 80,000 pounds. That's the tractor, the trailer, the fuel, the driver, and the freight. A typical tractor weighs about 17,000 to 20,000 pounds. An empty 53-foot dry van weighs about 14,000 to 15,000 pounds, so you've got roughly 45,000 to 48,000 pounds of payload capacity. That sounds like a lot until you start doing density math.
This is the space left but overweight problem.
A 53-foot trailer has about 3,800 cubic feet of interior volume. If your freight averages 10 pounds per cubic foot, which is fairly dense, think bagged cement or bottled water. You hit 45,000 pounds at about 4,500 cubic feet. But you only have 3,800 cubic feet available, so you're overweight before the trailer is full. For anything dense, the weight limit bites first. The trailer cubes out, runs out of volume. For lightweight freight like potato chips or insulation, it weighs out, hits the 80,000 pound limit for dense freight like paper, beverages, canned goods, steel.
And the bridge formula?
The bridge formula is a federal regulation that limits the weight on any group of axles based on the distance between them. The idea is to protect bridges from excessive stress. For a standard 5-axle tractor trailer, the practical effect is that you need at least 51 feet between the first and last axle to legally carry 80,000 pounds. The formula also limits individual axle weights: 20,000 pounds on a single axle, 34,000 on a tandem. This is why you see trailers with axles that slide forward and back. The driver adjusts the axle position to distribute weight legally across the axles and comply with the bridge formula for the specific load.
So the driver weighs the load, does math, and slides the axles.
At every truck stop scale. It's a daily ritual. And if you get it wrong, you get an overweight ticket. If you're way over, you can't move until you offload or redistribute. That's a very bad day.
Now the classification layer. NMFC. This is the part that sounds like complete madness to anyone outside the U.S.
It is. The National Motor Freight Classification System assigns every conceivable freight item to one of 18 classes, from Class 50 to Class 500. The class determines the base rate for LTL shipping. Class 50 is the cheapest, dense, easy-to-handle freight like bricks or gravel. Class 500 is the most expensive, light, bulky, fragile, or hard-to-handle items like ping pong balls or assembled furniture. The primary factor is density, pounds per cubic foot, but there are also adjustments for stowability, handling, and liability.
So how is a class actually assigned?
You look up your commodity in the NMFC book, which is thousands of pages, and find the item number that matches. That item number has a class. If your product isn't explicitly listed, you use the density. Measure the dimensions of your packaged product, calculate cubic feet, divide the weight by the cubic feet, and look up the density on the classification table. Under 1 pound per cubic foot is class 500. 1 to 2 pounds is class 400, and so on down to 50 pounds per cubic foot and above, which is class 50.
And what happens when the carrier disagrees with your class?
That's the reclass. The carrier inspects your shipment, either at the dock or at a weighing station, and decides you've underclassed it. They reclass it to a higher class, bill you the difference, plus an inspection fee. The bill shows up weeks later, and it's called a weight and inspection charge. It's one of the most contentious things in U.S. freight. Shippers hate it. Carriers say it's necessary because shippers constantly underdeclare. And the whole system is slowly shifting toward density-based rating anyway, where the class is determined purely by the dimensions and weight you provide, verified by the carrier's dimensioning equipment. The NMFC book is becoming less relevant as carriers move to dimensional pricing. Essentially, charge for the space you take up and the weight you bring.
So it's converging on what air freight already does.
Chargeable weight, whichever is greater, actual weight, or dimensional weight. The LTL industry is moving that direction, just slower.
Let's do the practical grammar. BOL versus CMR.
The Bill of Lading is the foundational document in U.S. freight. It's a contract of carriage, a receipt for the goods, and in some cases, a document of title. The CMR note is the European equivalent, governed by the CMR Convention, which is an international treaty standardizing cross-border road freight documentation. They serve similar purposes, but a U.S. BOL tends to have more legal weight domestically. If something goes wrong, the BOL terms and conditions are what govern the claim. In Europe, The CMR convention sets the liability framework by law, and the note is evidence of the contract.
Dock height.
U.S. dock height is standardized at about 48 to 52 inches. That matches the floor height of a standard dry van trailer. European dock height is often a bit lower, matching European truck heights. If you're a European shipper sending to a U.S. warehouse and your truck is at a different height, you need a dock leveler, a hydraulic or mechanical ramp that bridges the gap. Almost all U.S. docks have levelers, but it's one more point of friction.
Liftgate service.
A liftgate is a hydraulic platform mounted on the back of a truck that raises and lowers freight from ground level to the truck bed. If your shipment is going somewhere without a dock, a residential address, a small business, a construction site, you need a liftgate. It's a surcharge, typically $50 to $150. And it's tied to the residential delivery surcharge, which is another fee, because residential deliveries take longer, the driver has to navigate neighborhoods, there's no dock, and someone has to be home to receive.
Appointment scheduling and detention.
Most U.S. warehouses require delivery appointments. You can't just show up. If you miss your appointment window, you wait, sometimes hours, sometimes until the next day. Detention is the charge when a driver is held at a facility beyond the free time, which is typically 2 hours. The rate might be $50 to $100 per hour. Driver accessorials are all the extra charges. Detention, layover, driver assist for unloading, redelivery if the receiver refuses the shipment. U.S. freight runs on a thick layer of accessorial charges that don't always exist in the same form in Europe.
All right, the through line, imperial versus metric, what actually breaks?
The 1200 millimeter Euro pallet is about 47.24 inches. The GMA pallet is 48 by 40. If a European shipper designs cartons to fit perfectly on a 1200 by 800 Euro pallet, which is the standard footprint, and those cartons arrive at a U.S. warehouse and get placed on a GMA pallet, you've got a mismatch. The carton dimensions that divide cleanly into 1200 millimeters don't divide cleanly into 48 inches. You end up with overhang, product hanging off the edge of the pallet, or underhang, wasted space.
An overhang causes damage.
Overhang is the number one cause of pallet-related freight damage. The carton doesn't have the pallet edge supporting it, so when the load is strapped or wrapped, the overhanging cartons crush, or they snag on adjacent pallets during loading, or the whole load shifts in transit. And the damage isn't just the product, it's the restacking labor, the returns, the customer dissatisfaction.
Rack bay depths.
U.S. warehouse racking is designed around the GMA pallet. A standard selective rack bay is about 96 inches deep that fits two 48-inch pallets back-to-back with a little clearance. If you're putting 47-inch pallets in there, you've got extra clearance, which is fine, but wastes space. If you're putting metric pallets in, you might have to adjust beam depths. The bigger problem is when the pallet overhangs the beam entirely. That's a safety hazard. Pallets can fall through the rack.
So what does the mismatch actually cost?
It's hard to put a single number on it, but it shows up in damage rates, in load instability, in wasted cube in trucks and containers, in extra stretch wrap, in the labor to repalletize at the receiving dock. If you're a European shipper and you're not designing your packaging for the U.S. pallet from the start, you're paying for it somewhere downstream. The smart importers design cartons that work on both footprints, dimensions that divide reasonably into both 1200 millimeters and 48 inches. That usually means smaller cartons, which are more forgiving. A carton that's 300 by 400 millimeters fits neatly on a Euro pallet and also works on a GMA pallet with minimal overhang.
So where is the U.S. system better?
The 53-foot trailer is a genuine advantage for domestic freight. It moves more product per mile, per driver, per gallon of fuel than anything Europe can put on the road. Europe's truck length limits are tighter. The standard European semi-trailer is about 13.6 meters, which is about 44 feet. The U.S. gets 9 more feet of trailer. That's real efficiency. The U.S. also benefits from a simpler regulatory environment for domestic freight. One country, one set of rules, one language for documentation. Europe has 27 countries, 27 sets of rules, and constant border friction even with the single market.
And where is it just stubborn?
The imperial system. The refusal to metricate. The stringer pallet when the rest of the world moved to block. The NMFC classification book when dimensional pricing is simpler and more transparent. A lot of the U.S. system is path-dependent. We built it this way, the infrastructure is sunk, and changing would cost more than the inefficiency. But that doesn't mean it's optimal. It means it's locked in.
For an importer shipping into America, what should they design around from day one?
Design your packaging for the 48 by 40 GMA pallet footprint. That's non-negotiable. If you're shipping LTL, know your density and class before you ship. Don't let the carrier classify it for you, because they will, and you won't like the result. Understand that your freight will probably be transloaded at the port, and build pallet loads that survive a destuff and restuff. Use block pallets if you can. They handle better in U.S. warehouses, even if the stringer is still common. And if you're selling to a major retailer, ask about their pallet requirements before you ship. Walmart, Target, Costco, they all have their own specs, and they'll reject a load that doesn't comply.
Price in the accessorials. Residential delivery, liftgate detention. Those aren't surprises, they're line items.
The U.S. freight system is, it's like a language. You can learn the vocabulary and the grammar and get fluent, or you can pay someone to translate. But you can't just show up speaking metric and expect it to work.
The pallet is the first word.
The pallet is absolutely the first word.
If the U.S. system is so path-dependent and stubborn, why hasn't Amazon or Walmart just forced everyone onto a better standard? They have the buying power.
They've tried, in pieces. Walmart has their own pallet requirements, Amazon has their own, but they're variations on the GMA footprint, not a replacement. The problem is that forcing a new standard means forcing every supplier, every warehouse, every racking system, every truck configuration to change simultaneously. Even Walmart can't coordinate that. What they can do, and what they do, is impose strict compliance on their own supply chain. But they can't change the national infrastructure.
The other piece is that the GMA pallet actually works fine for most domestic freight. It's not broken enough to justify the cost of replacing it. The inefficiencies are real, but they're distributed across millions of shipments. No single player feels enough pain to lead a revolution. So we get incremental change. More block pallets through CHEP, more dimensional pricing in LTL, more transload efficiency at the ports. Evolution, not revolution.
Thanks, Hilbert.
Good question.
The thing I keep coming back to is that the U.S. system is optimized for scale. Bigger trailers, bigger warehouses, bigger loads. The inefficiencies are in the interfaces, where the U.S. system touches the rest of the world. That's where the friction lives.
That's where the money leaks. Every transload, every repalletization, every reclass, every inch of overhang. It's a tax on international trade that's baked into the physical infrastructure.
Daniel, you've now got the full set. Asia, Europe, and the U.S. Three incompatible pallet ecosystems, and the trucking and regulatory layers built on top of them. The world is flat, but the pallets aren't.
Thanks to Hilbert Flumentop for producing. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find every episode at myweirdprompts.com or email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.